Okay. So, I'm happy to be here with you. We're going to have our little two-day vacation with the Buddha. And we'll have some meditation and Dharma talks. In the afternoon, we'll do a discussion group. Because after lunch isn't a good time for meditating, usually here. Yes, but I'm sure if you talk, you'll stay wide awake. And then we'll have another teaching at the end of the day. And then tomorrow afternoon, a couple of people have requested to take refuge in the five precepts. So if people are interested, doing that, we can have the ceremony at the conclusion of the day. So just see the weekend as, you know, you're on a vacation with the Buddha. So forget about work, forget about, you know, everything else, and let's just focus on your practice and working on our mind. So, we'll start out with a little bit of meditation. At the beginning of the sessions, before the meditation, it's good to do some recitations to kind of prepare the mind. So we'll be doing two verses. This is the first one, it's Refuge and Bodhicitta. So the purpose of reciting the prayer for refuge in bodhicitta. We recite refuge in bodhicitta. The refuge prayer lets us be very clear about what spiritual tradition we're practicing, you know, that we're following the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the guidance of the three jewels. We're clear about the path that we're practicing. We know something, at least, about the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and have an appropriate kind of faith in them, and a willingness to listen to their instructions and follow the path. So, the refuge lets us know the direction that we're going in, the path that we're following, so that's very clear. Because when you follow a spiritual path, you have to know who your guides are and what your goal is. Otherwise, you're just kind of wandering in the dark. And then, so that's the first line where it says, I take refuge until I am awakened in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Okay? Then the second one by the merit, which version is this? By the merit I create by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. That is generating bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is the altruistic intention to become a fully awakened Buddha for the benefit of each and every sentient being. So it's a very noble intention, and we're setting that intention, you know, at the very beginning of what we're doing. And the intention is the most important part of creating the action, of doing the karma. You know, why we're doing it is really important. Yeah. So we're not saying, may I learn to meditate so I can be have less stress. That's a fine motivation, but it's not as long-term and complete as wanting to fully transform our mind, attain liberation, become a Buddha, and be able to benefit all beings. So we always make our intention the highest, the most noble one, and then in doing so, all the other things kind of come as byproducts. Yeah. So you will learn to have less stress and so on, but your intention is really for the benefit of all beings. And where it says generosity and the other far-reaching practices, that again, we're lost, aren't we? So this helps us get clear. And then the next verse is the four immeasurables, or the four Brahmaviharas. Okay. So may all sentient beings have happiness in its causes, that is generating love. Yeah. So you'll notice the difference here between Buddhist idea of love and what you hear on the radio and see in the movies. So it doesn't seem, may I fall madly in love with Buddha boy, who's my one and only that I can't live without. That's not the Buddhist notion of love. Okay, our notion of love is wishing others to have happiness and the causes of happiness. And then the second one, may all sentient beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. That's compassion. Yeah. So compassion isn't some kind of wimpy stuff like, oh, poor baby, you're suffering. Sorry, that's not compassion. Okay, compassion is simply the wish for others to be free of all the different kinds of suffering or dukkha, unsatisfactory conditions, and the causes of them. Then the third one is may all sentient beings never be separated from sorrowless bliss. That's joy. And here we're rejoicing in the virtues and the good opportunities of others. So this counteracts jealousy. And then the last one, may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger. That's equanimity. And that's wishing for all beings to have a very balanced mind. Not the emotional mind of, oh, I like this and I don't like that. I feel good, I feel miserable. You know, not our yo-yo emotional mind, but to have a mind of equanimity. Okay. And so doing the four immeasurables at the beginning of our meditation session also helps us have the right intention, the right motivation, a good attitude towards others. Because if we have a good attitude towards ourselves and towards other living beings, then it's going to be easier to meditate. If we sit down to meditate and we're angry, or we're filled with greed and dissatisfaction, it's difficult. It's going to be difficult to focus the mind. So when we recite these things, we're not just reciting them like a tape recorder. We're reciting them and thinking about the meaning and trying to transform our minds into that meaning. Okay. So when we talk about practicing the Dharma, practice means we do it again and again and again. Yeah. And so that's why we do these recitations at the beginning of all of our sessions, to practice clarifying our spiritual path, to practice clarifying our intention for progressively practicing that path. Okay? Yeah. So you can see in Buddhism there's reasons for everything that we do. It's not just kind of, well, somebody said that you chant this, so, well, I don't know why I chant it, but, you know, I'll chant it. You know, it's not like that. Yeah, there's a reason, there's a purpose for everything we do. So that's what I've been trying to explain in going over these verses right now. Okay? So, we'll start out reciting the verses, and then I'll guide you in a short body relaxation, and listen carefully, because in future sessions you're going to have to guide yourself through the body relaxation. And then after that we'll do some meditation on the breath to calm our mind before we have tea. there's many ways to meditate on the breath, many different ways. They're all fine. They don't contradict each other. So if you've heard another way before, that's fine. You can do that if you prefer that. Here, we're going to be doing the breathing meditation in order to stabilize our mind and to develop some concentration. So we're simply going to watch the inhale and exhale of the breath. You can watch it here at your upper lip and your nostrils, and you watch the sensation of the air as it passes there. Or you can watch here in your belly and watch the rise of your belly as you inhale, the fall of your belly as you exhale. Okay? And if you get distracted, you just notice your distraction. Don't start following the distraction. Because one distraction takes you to another distraction. So if you're sitting here and you feel, oh, the aircon, it's too cold. Why is the aircon too cold? It's also too cold in my workplace. Why do they keep the aircon too cold? Then I'm shivering. Then I have to put something on in my workplace. They don't like us to wear something. And then the colleagues make a comment about why I have a big sweater on in the workplace because it's too cold. And I don't like when my colleagues make comments about what I'm wearing. But everybody makes comments about what I do all the time. And these people just drive me crazy. They're all so opinionated. Okay? Do you see what I'm talking about? It starts out with just feeling a little cold. And then pretty soon your mind is off, you know? With attachment and anger. So instead, just notice, then come back to the breath. And when you're watching the breath, you can sometimes be aware of how your breath connects you to life in general. You can also be aware of the changing nature of your breath. How the breath doesn't remain the same in the very next moment. And if you can pay attention to that, it's quite interesting because you're really watching impermanence and watching change and realizing that our breath is not one, you know, solid event, but it's many micro events. So we'll do that for a bit and then we'll have teachings. So if you need to squirm, squirm now. Okay, stretch your legs, wiggle now. And then for your meditation position, you want to sit with your leg cross-legged and your hands in your lap, right on the left. Touching like this. So your hands are against your body. Don't put your hands out here in your lap. Your hands are against your body. So then there's very naturally, if you do that, you see there's some natural space between your body and your arm. And that allows for some circulation. And then your head is level. Maybe you tuck your chin in just a little bit. Yeah, but not too much because if you tuck your chin in, it usually keeps going down. Okay. And then breathe through your nose. Unless your nose is plugged, then breathe any way you can. Let your body and your mind relax and focus. So when we start with the chanting at the beginning of the two verses, we we imagine in the space in front of us, the Buddha surrounded by other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and Arhats, all the holy beings, because when we're taking refuge, we're not taking refuge in empty space. So we imagine the Buddha, the body of golden light, is looking at us, smiling, and then, you know, he's surrounded by the other holy beings, and then we say,
I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings.
May all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free of suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings not be separated from sorrowless bliss. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger.
So we'll begin the body scan by feeling ourselves sitting here on the cushion. So be aware of the physical sensations of your body sitting here. Belly is knotted up because you hold your stress there. Try and just let that tightness in your belly go. Let your belly relax. Shoulders fall very quickly. And move them around. muscles are tightened and we don't realize it, or our jaw is clenched and we're also not aware of it. So if that's the case, try and just let that tension go. So come back once more to an awareness of your entire body and be aware how your posture is firm and also relaxed at the same time. There's no tension. And focus on your breath. Natural. Don't deep breathe or try and regulate your breath. Just let it be the way it is. But put your attention on the upper lip or on the belly. Keep it on one of those places. Don't go back and forth between them. And simply watch the breath from that perspective. Being aware of all the different things that are going on as you inhale, all the things going on as you exhale. So we'll have some time of silence, about 2 minutes. So you can do this.
Very often, we aren't aware of what our intent is.
thought pops into our mind, it can be an impulsive thought, and we just follow it and go along with it. So being unaware of our intentions can be a big problem, because the intentions which exist in the mind lead us to move our body, to communicate, to think about different things. So it's very important to be aware of our intentions. So there's one, there's two mental factors that are quite important in terms of being aware of our intentions. One is mindfulness, and that's a mind, a mental factor that is aware of our values, our precepts, how we want to act, how we don't want to act. And the second one is introspective awareness, which is another mental factor that checks up, am I concentrating, or am I falling asleep, am I distracted, what is going on in my mind? Okay. So if we can be mindful and have, you know, in our mind how we want to act, then that solves a lot of problems to begin with. And then if we have the introspective awareness, you know, making sure that we stay focused and we're aware of what we're doing, then our actions, body, speech, and mind, tend to be gentler, have better intentions, and so on. When we lack that kind of mental introspection or mindfulness, then any kind of thought pops into our mind and we just follow it without considering its impact or its consequences. Okay. So we do this a lot, unfortunately, and then we get ourselves into problems because of it. Have you ever been in the middle of a situation and said, why am I here doing this? This is not what I want to be doing. Have you ever had that happen? Have you ever been in the middle of saying something and one part of your mind says, be quiet. You don't really mean this. This isn't true. But it keeps coming out of your mouth anyway. I think, you know, if we have some self-awareness, we've seen that we've had these kinds of experiences, not just once, but probably many times. Yeah. And so it's quite important to develop that kind of self-awareness. And so the awareness is of our intention, yeah, but it's also of what comes about due to our intention. What is our body doing? What is our mouth doing? What is our mind doing? And because this is karma, these actions of body, speech, and mind are karma. And we live in the what's called the desire realm. The desire realm is a realm of living beings, where there's lots of attractive external objects to desire. So there's beautiful things to look at, nice sounds to hear, nice smells, nice tastes, nice tactile sensations. And so if we look at most of our life, we are distracted by the five sense objects that are external. And so our mind pays attention to external things instead of paying attention to our intention or paying attention to what our body, speech, and mind are doing. Okay. So, for example, we'll look at outside, we'll be walking down the street, then we'll see something in a shop window, and we'll go, oh boy, that's really, I like that. You know, we walk past a car place, right? People like cars. Oh, look at that car. That car is so great. I want that car. Oh, I don't have enough money. How can I get enough money? Well, I have to work, and then I'll save it up, and then I'll get that car sometime in the future. And what are the features I want in the car? Well, I want one of the GPS systems. I want one of those, you know, where you can play your CDs. I want a phone in the car, so I don't have to pick up my handphone. I can just, you know, they have phones in cars. And you start imagining, oh, I want this car. And your mind's off. What's influencing your mind? What mental state is that when you're dreaming about the car you want to get? Yeah. It's attachment, isn't it? It's desire. Oh, I want that, I want that. But your mind is on the car. Are you aware that you have attachment in your mind at that moment? No. Yeah. But there's no self-awareness because we're focused externally on the object of desire. So because there's no self-awareness of our own attachment, our own planning, all these kinds of things, then that can lead us to do all sorts of actions that, you know, can bring problems. Same thing with anger. Are you, you know, are we aware when anger is arising in our mind? Or are we only aware of anger when it's full blown and we're furious and we're ready to punch somebody in the nose? And sometimes, even though our anger's, you know, full blown, and we're yelling and screaming at somebody, or we're so mad that we just walk away and close the door and don't talk to them, we still aren't even aware if we're angry. Somebody can come up to us and say, "You seem rather angry." And we go, "What are you talking about? I'm not angry. Leave me alone." Yeah? There's no self-awareness at that moment. And so when we aren't aware of our anger, what happens? We spew our anger out over the environment. Even if you're not somebody who yells and screams, you're somebody who shuts down when you're angry and becomes very quiet. Still, the energy of your anger is felt in the environment. Have you been around people who are ice cold when they're angry? Yeah. Like you're sitting at a family dinner and the table's completely silent and you're ready, because you know one relative is angry, you're ready for the blow up. Because that's not saying anything. But the energy is there. Okay. So when we aren't aware of what's going on in our mind, we affect the environment. And then we also wind up doing actions that leave karmic seeds or karmic latencies on our mind stream. So karma is the actual action. Yeah. When we do an action, yeah, the action may end, but what is left is some kind of residual energy. So we call that a karmic seed. Yeah. So the karmic seed is the residual energy left over from that action. And that energy is there on a the cooperative conditions come together, then that potency, that energy ripens, and we experience its result. Okay? So when we talk about the law of karma and its effects, we're talking about a system of causality. Yeah? Just like biology, chemistry, physics, those are all systems of causality. And you know, if you put certain things together or do certain things, it brings a certain result. Well, similarly, in terms of our actions, yeah, our actions bring different results. And one of the chief factors that influences the action, the result of our action, is our intention. Why we did the action. What was our motivation? So that's why it's so important to be aware of what's going on in our mind. Okay. So we have the mental aspect of the intention, which is karma. Then we have thoughts that develop in our mind, maybe thoughts of coveting other people's things, thoughts of how to take revenge on somebody we don't like, you know, all sorts of misconceptions that go on in our mind. Then we have how we communicate with other people. That's a little bit grosser. What's happening in our mind is more subtle. Yeah. Then what comes out of our mouth or how we communicate is a little bit grosser. And without the mind moving, the mouth doesn't move. So sometimes our intentions happen very quickly and we're not aware of them, but our mouth is moving and we're saying something. Okay. Then also, a little bit grosser action than that is our body. Then we express our intention with our body. All of those actions leave these karmic seeds on our mind stream. So all day long, we're creating all sorts of actions, creating karma, and putting many, 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 many karmic seeds on our mind stream. The karmic seeds, yeah, don't always ripen and produce their result immediately. When we do some actions, sometimes some part of the result comes immediately. But the immediate result isn't necessarily the karmic result. The karmic result can be experienced also in future lifetimes. Because it depends upon when the conditions are ready for these seeds to ripen. Yeah, there's the analogy of when you plant seeds in the ground. I know Singaporeans aren't gardeners very much. When Singaporeans come to the Abbey, they always look at the plants. Wow, there are the apples growing on the trees. I thought apples grew in the supermarket. They grow on trees, imagine that. You know? So, yeah, but I think you know the idea that, that they're seeds and then they grow into plants. But, you know, when you plant a seed, you don't get the fruit right away. Sometimes you plant the seeds in the autumn and the you know, it doesn't grow until the springtime. Or you plant it in the early spring and it doesn't grow until the summer because you need other conditions. The seed alone, although it might be the principal cause, is not the only cause. You need the conditions. You need the right temperature. You need the right amount of water. You need some fertilizer in the ground. So you have to have these other surrounding conditions for the seed to grow. Similarly, with the seeds in our mind, it depends on the surrounding conditions in our life, what seeds grow. And I'll get into that a little bit more. Okay? So then we have to ask, why is understanding karma important? Yeah. Buddhists talk a whole lot about it. Why is understanding it important? Because we create the cause for our own experiences. And we all want to be happy, don't we? We all want to be free of suffering. But the principal causes for both our happiness and our suffering is our own actions. We usually think the principal cause for our happiness and our suffering is the external environment. But that's an incorrect view. That's part of our ignorance. Okay. So, for example, let's say somebody criticizes me. I think we've all been criticized, right? Anybody here has never, ever, ever been criticized? We've all been criticized, right? Okay. When somebody criticizes us and our feelings are hurt and we get angry, what do we think is the cause of our hurt feelings and our anger? Yeah. We usually say that person. Why do I have hurt feelings? Because you hurt my feelings. Why am I angry? Because you insulted me. So we're always pointing the finger outside. Similarly, when we're happy, we mistakenly think that our happiness comes from outside. Somebody comes and looks at us and says, "You're wonderful." Finally, somebody recognized. Yeah. "Oh, you're so wonderful. Your eyes are like diamonds. Your teeth are like pearls." You know, all this kind of rubbish. But anyway, we love it, don't we? We don't care if it's rubbish or not. We love it. Somebody's praising us. "You're so intelligent, you're so good looking, you're so rich." I'm not really looking for somebody rich, but it's helpful. Yeah. "You're so artistic, you're so athletic, you're so musical, you're everything." Somebody says that to us, yeah, we feel happy, right? Somebody's praising us. What do we think is the cause of our happiness? That person. Yeah, that person's the cause of my happiness because he or she praises me. So I want to be near that person all the time because I like being happy and their praise is the cause of my happiness. Okay, that's the way we look at things, isn't it? Okay, we're beings in the desire realm. We're so enamored with external objects. We're so addicted to the feelings that seem to arise due to contact with external objects, be they pleasant feelings or unpleasant feelings. And so we experience those feelings. Pleasure, pain, then pleasure, I like, attachment comes. Cling, I want, I crave, I need, gimme, gimme, gimme. Okay? And our wishes are frustrated, then anger comes. "I didn't get that happiness. Instead of praising me, they criticized me." We get angry. we will act in one way or another. They're praising me, they make me happy, I'm attached, I want more, 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 more. And so then maybe we start to manipulate the other person so that they'll think that we're really wonderful. We drop hints of what they can do. We do all sorts of stuff, don't we, to get people to praise us. Sometimes we even act contrary to our own ethical values, because we want to go along with what somebody else thinks, or we want to go along with what somebody else wants, so that that person will like us and praise us. Okay? Can you remember situations where maybe you did that? Against your better judgment, you went along with what other people wanted so that they would like you. You're not talking to me, are you? Yes, I am. Because I've done it too. And then the same thing with anger. When we're angry, that causes us to act. Some people are yellers and screamers. Some people are give us the chilling effect. Yeah. How many of you are yellers and screamers? Oh, come on. I can't believe four people. I guess all those other people we hear yelling and screaming are other people. Because you don't yell and scream. Let's try this one. How many of you get so angry that you don't talk to the other person? Oh, okay. A few more people are being honest. So either way, our behavior affects the other person, doesn't it? And it affects our own mind. So it puts karmic seeds in our mind, in the same way that our attachment and clinging puts karmic seeds in our mind. Now, because attachment and anger are both based on ignorance, because they misunderstand things and make us do actions that are very self-centered, don't you think? When you're acting under the influence of clinging attachment, are you self-centered at that moment? How about when you're acting under the influence of anger? Are you self-centered? Yeah. By self-centered, I mean my happiness matters more than anybody else's. So we're functioning under the influence of ignorance and self-centeredness. So the karma, the action we're doing, is going to be destructive or non-virtuous or unwholesome, whatever word you want to use to describe it. In other words, it's going to be an action that will result in our own suffering at some later time. So even though we want happiness, because our mistaken view that thinks that happiness and suffering come from outside of ourself, and because of the actions we do to get what we want and to get away from what we don't want, then we're putting these imprints of negativity in our own mind. And when they ripen, they create our experience. They ripen in our being happy or our being miserable. So if we go back to that initial action, you may say, but this person who's praising me, is making me feel happy. So isn't that somehow virtuous? My happy feeling? The feeling we experience is the result of previously created karma. Yeah. The person who is praising us in the moment is only the cooperative condition. The principal cause was our being kind to somebody else with a good intention in the past. Okay? So when we feel happiness, the happiness is due to some virtuous action that we did in the past. It's not due to our non-virtuous actions. And its principal cause is not the other person. The other person is only the condition. Okay? In a similar way, sometimes we're in a bad mood, or sometimes we're unhappy about what's happening in our life. We usually think the cause is the external world. The principal cause is not. The principal cause is our previously created karma, maybe even in a previous life, that is now ripening as our unhappiness. Okay. The other person saying or doing whatever they did that we don't like is just the cooperative condition. The real thing is our own action. And again, because we're unhappy, now whenever we're unhappy, it's the result of non-virtuous karma. Whenever we feel happy, it's the result of virtuous karma. Yeah. So the immediate situation that happened right before our feeling of happiness is only the cooperative condition. Okay? So, in other words, a lot of our experience is dependent on things that, actions that we did a long time ago. Okay? Sometimes we may not even remember what those actions are because they were done in a previous life. Now, you might say, but my previous life was a different person. So just because my previous life might have been a jerk, why do I have to suffer with the karma from my previous life ripening upon me now? So you might say, oh, that's a totally different person. Why am I experiencing the results of what they did? Well, they're not exactly a totally different person. Our previous lives are not the same person that we are now, because we have a different body, a different name, you know. We're not exactly the same person as in our previous lives. But we're not a totally different person either, because there's continuity between our previous life and this life. So what is that continuity? It's the mental consciousness, or the mere I. Yeah, there's a continuity of the person. There is no soul. There is no concrete self that is me that continues from previous life to this life. But there is the continuity of the impermanent, ever-changing mind stream of one moment of mind following the next moment of mind. There is that continuity. And so the seeds from the actions we did before follow us from one life into another life. They don't get lost. I remember the the first time I used a computer, maybe 1986, and the computers weren't so good at that time, and I didn't know that you had to save your file a lot. So I just kept typing. I worked for maybe 3 or 4 hours transcribing something. Then I tried to save it. It was too big. It wouldn't save. Everything got erased. So a computer file, you can make a boo-boo, and all your work goes bye-bye. Okay? With karma, we can make mistakes, but the karmic seeds don't disappear. Not like those computer files that get lost. Okay. We can destroy the karma, but if it's not destroyed, it definitely brings the result. Sometimes we wish our negative actions were like those computer files that vanish. But we still have vanishing computer files, don't we? Yeah. You work on something, type something, save it, it's not there. It happens to me a lot. I can complain about this a lot. But my karma, yeah, it always brings a result unless I do something to change it. Okay, so there's 4 main characteristics of karma that will help us understand how karma works. Okay? First characteristic is that karma is definite. What that means is that happiness always comes from virtuous actions. Unhappiness always comes from non-virtuous actions. Yeah, that's definite. Now, what determines whether something is virtuous or non-virtuous? Because it's important to know this. Yeah. So the principal thing, not the only thing, but the principal thing is our intention. The Buddha also gave us a list of 10 destructive actions that when most people do them, they're non-virtuous, unless somebody, you know, is kind of an exceptional person. We'll get into that in a little bit. When we talk about what actions are virtuous and what are non-virtuous, that determination is made solely with respect to the result they bring. Do they bring happiness or do they bring suffering in the long term? Okay. So it's never, and how do we know what brings happiness and suffering in the long term? The Buddha, due to his realizations, his mind was unclouded with defilements. And so he could automatically see when sentient beings are experiencing happiness, then he knew what actions they did that were the principal cause of that happiness. He called those actions virtue or wholesome. Now, when sentient beings experience pain and misery, he saw what actions were the cause of those. Those actions were called non-virtue or unwholesome or destructive. Okay? So the Buddha himself did not create the law of karma. The Buddha himself did not say, you know, thou shalt not do this and that, because if you do, it's finished, you know? There is no punishment or reward. The Buddha just described this mental functioning, this natural law of cause and effect that functions on an ethical level within our mind stream. So we see that virtue and non-virtue don't have some kind of inherent nature, but those actions are posited as virtue or non-virtue with respect to the result that they bring. This is quite important because when we start talking about emptiness and things lacking any inherent essence, it also applies to karma. When we talk about dependent arising, things being considered virtue or non-virtue depends on the result. So it's a dependent process. Quite important. Okay. So that's the first quality of karma. So non-virtue never produces happiness, and virtue never produces suffering. So when we act with a good intention and a virtuous action, we don't need to worry about the result. It will produce happiness. Maybe not in the very next 10 minutes, but sometime along our mental continuum when it ripens. And the same thing with non-virtue. We may do, we may tell somebody off. We're really mad at them, and we tell them off, and then we go, I'm so happy I hurt that person's feelings. So you might think, oh, I'm happy. Yeah, the action I did was good. No, telling somebody off is not a virtuous action. It will eventually result in pain on our part. Okay. That's the first thing. Second attribute of karma is that a small action can bring a big result. So it's kind of like when you plant seeds. Yeah. A seed is really tiny, but it can produce a huge tree. Where I live at the Abbey, we work in the forest, we have huge, huge trees in some places. And it's amazing, you look at this tree that's like way up there, and you think, from one small seed. Yeah, it's really kind of amazing when you think, how did something that big produce this enormous tree? Yeah. Well, in the same way, a small action can lead to a big result in the future. Okay? So we shouldn't kind of ignore that. Sometimes we say, well, it's just a little white lie. And a little, a little white lie. It's not so bad. It won't produce such a bad result. But that's not necessarily true. Because if it sits in our mind and gestates in our mind, that tiny little white lie can produce a big result. Let's say, for example, that people in our workplace don't believe us. Even when we're telling the truth, they don't listen to us, pay us any attention, or believe us. And maybe that came from that tiny lie. So when we understand this, then we become more vigilant, more careful. We don't want to create even small negative actions. Similarly, on the side of virtue, small virtuous action can produce a huge result. They tell the story, King Ashoka, the great Buddhist king, who was very, very wealthy and very powerful. They say that at the time of the Buddha, he was a small boy, and he didn't have anything to offer the Buddha, but he had much respect for the Buddha. So he had, I think it may be a grain, you know, a handful of rice or, you know, some small thing that he offered the Buddha. And because often, you know, generosity is the cause of wealth, that offering that small handful of rice to the Buddha resulted in his incredible wealth as King Ashoka in a later life. So when we understand this, then we take every opportunity we can to create virtue. We don't say, well, it's just a small virtue, why do it? Okay? So for example, every day when we get up, yeah, if you have a shrine in your home, an altar in your home, with pictures of the Buddha, yeah, the bodhisattvas, your teacher, you know, different holy objects, then it's really nice first thing in the day, make some offerings. It's an act of generosity. It's just the feeling of taking something and giving it, you know? Because usually we're going like this. Usually the hand's like this. So to start the day out with the hand going like this is quite good. Yeah? So we can offer water bowls, some fruit, incense, light, you know, whatever, flowers, whatever we consider beautiful. It's just something small. It takes all of maybe 30 seconds maybe. Yeah, depending what you offer. But if you offer it with an attitude of respect for the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, you offer it with the thought, may this result in the enlightenment of myself and all living beings, then due to the power of your virtuous intention and making an offering to the Triple Gem, it can have huge results in the future. So it's good to take advantage of that and create just small acts of generosity. In addition to creating the cause for future happiness, it makes you feel better in this life also. So small acts of kindness, they have a bumper sticker in the US that says, do random acts of kindness. My country is usually known for random acts of violence. Yeah. So this is trying to change it. Random acts of kindness. You know what happened one time? Sometimes people do this. Is, you know, drive-through things, you know, like at McDonald's or something, where you place an order and then you get out. So one person, and he said, I want to pay for also for the person behind me. So that when the person behind me comes to collect his food, he doesn't have to pay anything. I want to make it an offering. The person behind him, of course, is a stranger. You know, when you're doing drive-through at McDonald's, you don't know all the people behind you. So he paid for the person behind him. Then that person was so touched by this guy in front of him paying for him that he paid for the person behind him. And then that person paid for the person behind him. And it went on for over 400 customers. Can you imagine that? 400 people, you know, so inspired to pay for the food of strangers who were the people behind them. I thought that was wonderful, you know? Just the feeling that people had, I've been the recipient of kindness in my life. I want to pay it forward. I want to do something for others. I heard something similar also happening in terms of, I think it was kidney transplants. Yeah, that one person, you know, gave a kidney to a stranger. then a relative of that stranger donated a kidney to somebody else. And that went on for many people. I forget how many. But boy, offering a kidney is very different than offering food, isn't it? But again, people were inspired by random acts of kindness to extend kindness towards others. I thought that was just amazing. How many of us would give our kidney to a stranger? We would happily accept a kidney from a stranger if we needed a kidney transplant, wouldn't we? Do we want to give a kidney to a stranger? Let somebody else do that. Yeah? But it's because somebody else does it that the people who need kidney transplants have it. Quite remarkable, really. Okay? So, second factor about karma. A small action can bring a big result. So, pay attention also to small things. The third attribute of karma is if you don't create the cause, you won't experience the result. So this is important, you know, because lots of times we want happiness, but we don't want to create the causes for it. We have this feeling like, I'm me, and I'm wonderful, and I deserve happiness, and the universe owes it to me. Maybe we don't think that so consciously, and we're not aware of it. But inside there's this thought of, I want happiness, and the universe should provide it to me. And I will do as little as possible to get it. It's kind of like, you know, when you're studying for your tests, you only learn as much as you need to learn to pass the test. Yeah, you don't learn other things that may be useful later on. Okay? But if we don't create the cause, we don't experience the result. So then the people say, well, what about praying? Does praying and making requests to the Buddha, does that create the cause for happiness? Yeah. Praying and making requests is a cooperative condition that can help our virtuous karma ripen. But it itself is not virtuous karma. So we shouldn't have the idea that I just sit here and say, Buddha, please help my family to be wealthy. Yeah. Help me to meet some wonderful person to marry, or help my children meet wonderful people to marry. Help me to have a good career and be famous. Help me to be well-liked. Please, Buddha, give me happiness. So you make lots of prayers and requests. Then, do you do any virtuous actions? No. You sit there. I feel like drinking tea. I feel like eating chocolate. Yeah. I don't feel like going to work. I don't need to be kind to anybody else. I pray to the Buddha. The Buddha's going to make me happy. Doesn't work that way. Okay? We have to create the causes for our own happiness. If we don't create the causes, we won't have the happiness we want. Yeah. Similarly, if we don't create the causes for suffering, we won't experience suffering. So So it's something, you know, when things happen to us sometimes that we don't like. Yeah. Like when we get sick, or we have some kind of misfortune. We always say, why me? Why does this happen to me? Why doesn't it happen to somebody else? Why me? Why us? Because we created the karmic cause. If we didn't create the cause for illness or poverty or whatever, financial problems, those things wouldn't happen to us. We created the cause. The principal cause. So it could have been in a previous lifetime. You know, maybe we, in a previous lifetime, we're very stingy. Then it ripens this lifetime having financial problems. Maybe in a previous lifetime we got in a fight with somebody and injured them. And it ripens this lifetime in our having illness. Something like that. Okay. So that third quality, you know, if you don't create the cause, you don't experience the result. So if we don't, you know, act in non-virtuous ways, then we won't have suffering. Yeah. If we don't create virtue, we also won't have happiness. Just praying to the Buddha doesn't do it. Because the Buddha is not omnipotent. The Buddha is not all-powerful. They say that the power of the Buddha and the power of our karma are equal. The Buddha can't override our karma. If the Buddha could override our karma, then he would have, and he would have stopped all the suffering in the world. Because there's no reason to suffer. You know, if you are omnipotent and all-powerful, why do you let other beings suffer when you can stop it? Yeah. But the Buddha can't override our karma. The Buddha helps us. The Buddha does everything he can to lead us to happiness. But it depends also on what we do. Yeah. There's a joke somewhere I heard. Yeah. What was that joke? Oh. Yeah, so there's somebody who's praying, you know, Buddha, 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 I want to win the lottery. Please help me to win the lottery. You know, and the person prays and prays and prays to win the lottery. The lottery's drawn. The person doesn't win. The person goes back to the Buddha. Buddha, I didn't win the lottery. You know, what happened? Buddha says, you didn't buy a ticket. Yeah. In other words, we have to do something. Yeah. Don't pray to the Buddha to win the lottery. Please, that's kind of a waste of time. And it's a waste of your money to buy lottery tickets also. Better to do something more worthwhile. Okay? But the idea is, if we don't create the cause, we don't get the result. Praying is not sufficient. Praying is a help, but it's not the main cause. Then the fourth attribute of karma is that the karmic seeds don't get destroyed. So this is what I was talking about earlier. Yeah, we do an action, those karmic seeds are implanted on the continuum of our mind. They don't disappear like our computer files. We can counteract some of them, okay? We can limit how they ripen and even eventually stop them from ripening. But if we don't do that, they will ripen sometime or another, okay? So, for example, in terms of our negative karma, yeah, it will definitely ripen unless we do purification practice. If we do purification practice, and we'll get into this, how you do it, then the purification practice can reduce the potency, the power of that karmic seed, so that if it ripens, it will ripen as a small suffering instead of as a big one. Or instead of ripening soon, it will ripen later on, giving us more time to do more purification. Okay. Or if it was going to be a suffering that lasted a long time, it'll ripen a short bit of suffering. Okay. But we have to do the purification practice for that to happen. Then, in terms of the positive karma, if we dedicate our merit, then it will definitely ripen. It's not going to vanish. However, if we get angry and if we have wrong views, that can impede the ripening of our positive karma. Okay? So maybe there's some karma that was going to ripen in like a wonderful situation for us, but because we got angry, it just ripens in a small bit of happiness. Or it was going to ripen in a long period of happiness. Instead, it's a short period. Or maybe the happiness was going to come sooner. Instead, it comes later. Okay? So, you know, the good news is that we can purify our non-virtue. But on the other hand, we can also destroy our virtuous karma. So we have to be careful. You know, when we get angry, when we generate wrong views, because that can be very harmful to us. And in the same way, it's very helpful to do purification practices on a regular basis, because that really helps us to reduce the impact of our non-virtue. Okay. So, we're at a point where we can break. Do we have the lunch, the offerings for lunch? I know that you probably have questions from what I said. If you have questions during the lunch break, please write them down, and then you can leave them up here, and I'll answer them later on. Okay. And then we're going to do some recitations to offer our food. So this is a practice. Remember I talked about small practices that we do to create virtue that can ripen in big result? So this is one of them. Yeah, we're doing a small practice of offering our food to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. We begin that practice with the... do we have the five contemplations? Yes. Okay. Shall we do the five contemplations first? We recite each one and then we're going to pause to actually think about it. And then we'll recite the next one and pause and think about it. So the five contemplations help us to set our motivation for eating. Okay, so we're eating with a sense of the kindness of, and a feeling of gratitude for others. We're eating with the intention to improve our practice, with the intention to guard our mind so we don't become full of greed, you know, wanting to snatch everybody else's food because it's so delicious. Yeah, we eat, again, treating the food as wondrous medicine to nourish our body. You know? And then we do it with the ultimate aim of sustaining our body so that we can practice the path to full awakening. So we're generating this wonderful bodhicitta intention just for eating our lunch. So that's very, very virtuous. Then we go on And we have three verses here. The top verse is praise to the Buddha, showing respect to the Buddha. The second verse is respect and homage to the Dharma. Third verse, the third verse on the next frame, respect for the Sangha. Then the bottom verse there is where we're actually offering the food. So we imagine the food, you know, instead of being ordinary food, we imagine it transforming into blissful wisdom nectar, and we offer this blissful wisdom nectar to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then the verse after that, we are dedicating the merit of our offering, saying, may we never be separated from the Triple Gem. May we always be able to make offerings to them. And then, then the verse after that, then it's also reaffirming our intention and dedicating that we're not eating, that we will eat, seeing the food as medicine. We're not going to be attached to it. We're not going to complain about it. Okay, we're going to have a feeling of gratitude for it, and then eat it to nourish our bodies so we can practice the path. Okay? So we'll start at the beginning.
If we want to do replication,
yeah. We'll, I think we'll wait on the dedication of merit, because the food offering contains that also. Okay, so Venerable Senkei will lead us in this.
I contemplate all the causes and conditions and the kindness of others by which I have received this food.
Separated from the Triple Gem in any of our lives. May we always have the opportunity to make offerings to them, and may we continuously receive their blessings and inspiration to progress along the path. By seeing this food as medicine, I will consume it without attachment or complaint, not to increase my arrogant strength or good looks, but solely to sustain my life.
Then when you eat the food, you can imagine a small Buddha made of light at your heart, and the food as blissful wisdom nectar that you're offering to the Buddha at your heart. And then the Buddha radiates light, and that light fills your body as you're So we'll take a break now. I think it's an hour and 15 minutes, okay? So until 1:15. And during the break time, how about if we keep silence? Yeah. So don't pull out your phone and start texting. I know you'll say it's, but it's silent. You know? Or calling people on your phone or chattering. Keep some, you know, because if we create a quiet environment here, when we come back, then our mind is already stilled and it becomes easier to listen and meditate and so on. So, also, if you want to get one of the books, you can during the break. You can read in the break, take a walk, do some exercise. Yeah? But let's keep